One of the most popular institutions in religion today is the modern Sunday school. It has not, however, always been that way. Did you ever wonder how this institution came into existence? Exactly where, when, and by whom? To study the history of this movement is very interesting and also enlightening. Sooty Alley was an unlikely place. The year 1780 was certainly an unlikely year, and Robert Raikes was an unlikely man, and yet all three of these played a part in the beginning of the modern Sunday school movement. Raikes, editor of the Gloucester Journal, was born in the year 1735. His schemes to teach children came about by accident. One day, while in the company of several businessmen, he passed through the urban slums inhabited by employees of the pen manufacturing industry. Stricken by the horrible conditions that were everywhere evident, he asked a woman if the children playing in the street belonged to that part of town. Her reply would become the catalyst for a movement that eventually shook the foundations of religious education. For she told the man that while the scene that day was very horrible, "You should see it on Sunday," she said, "because the street is filled with boys and girls who have nowhere else to go and nothing else to do." Thus, in Sooty Alley in the year 1780, Robert Raikes gathered a few children together to teach them and to read to them from the church catechism. On November 3, 1793, he made known to the world his scheme of Sunday schools through the columns of the Gloucester Journal. Within 4 years, it would grow to include over 250,000 children. Even though the new idea spread quickly, it certainly was not without opposition. In 1798, Thomas Burns preached 2 sermons against the introduction of the system into Scotland. The preceding year, an article had appeared in Gentleman's Magazine of London, in which the writer charged, "We may, therefore, conclude that the Sunday school is so far from being the wise, useful, or prudential institution it is said to be, that it is in reality productive of no valuable advantage." There were others who questioned the usefulness of Sunday schools, some even condemning it as being dangerous and a demoralizing institution of the devil. The Archbishop of Canterbury called together the bishops to consider what should be done to stop the movement. William Pitt thought seriously of introducing into Parliament a bill for the suppression of Sunday schools. In Scotland, teaching on the Sabbath by laymen was pronounced a violation of the Fourth Commandment. Those who fostered schools among the poor were condemned and their teachers persecuted by the church. This view, however, obviously did not prevail. The movement in England continued to move forward. But the question that we are primarily concerned with is whether or not Sunday schools are apostolic in their origin, whether or not the idea itself began with God or began with man. We have already pointed out the work of Robert Raikes, but we need also to mention the fact that there have always been rumors and claims of Sunday schools that existed before the work of Raikes. A controversy over these claims has long been in existence and is still unsettled even to this present time. The question is not simply one of priority of date, since form and other identifying features enter into the dispute. The so-called Sunday schools in New England prior to 1780 have been classified by some as actually day schools, with neither form nor methods of the modern Sunday school movement. In 1737, John Wesley is said to have begun a Sunday school in Savannah, Georgia. Later writings by Wesley, however, seem to indicate that he knew nothing of Sunday schools until about 1783 or 85. It does appear that there were schools in existence prior to 1780 that were at least similar to those originated by Robert Raikes. But what about the movement among those claiming to restore primitive Christianity? It should come as no surprise that the early leaders of the Restoration movement were opposed to Sunday schools. It was part and parcel of a denominational system that was being rejected by these men in an attempt to restore the ancient order of things. Alexander Campbell wrote in 1823, "Their churches were not fractured into missionary societies, education societies, nor did they dream of organizing such in the world. The head of a believing household was not in those days a president or manager of a board of foreign missions, his wife the president of some female education society, his eldest son the recording secretary of some domestic Bible society, his eldest daughter the corresponding secretary of a mite society, his servant maid the vice president of a rag society, or his little daughter a tutoress of a Sunday school. They knew nothing of the hobbies of modern times. In their church capacity alone they moved." Even though Campbell's remarks in this particular article seem to reject what he considered to be a hobby, his main objection was to the misuse of that system rather than an indictment of the system itself. History would bear out that in later years, Campbell not only would come to accept the Sunday schools, but even encourage them. Barton Stone's views, however, represent a somewhat different picture. While opposing the Sunday school as an institution, he supported its real function, that is, the teaching of the Bible. He was opposed to the American Sunday School Union and to Sunday school tracts. Yet, regarding the Lord's Day worship, he felt it important that children should be taught. Part of the early objections to Sunday schools among leaders of the Restoration Movement centered around the fact that it was a separate institution from the church, and thus was lacking in scriptural authority. Once the work, however, came under the auspices of the local congregation, much of the opposition ceased. Bauer and Ross point to August 6, 1832 issue of the Millennial Harbinger as the first direct reference to a Sunday school within the framework of the Restoration Movement. This is what the notice said. I quote, "Something more than a year ago, a Sunday school was opened at our place of public worship. The youth and children of the neighborhood who were capable of reading understandingly, together with all others who felt friendly disposed thereto, were invited to attend." That was in 1832. In 1834, John T. Johnson reported on the establishment of a Sunday school in Georgetown, Kentucky. That means that the Church of Jesus Christ had been in existence for almost 1,800 years before a modern Sunday school became a part of its work program. Now, it would be wrong to say that churches began to adopt the Sunday school immediately. It was questioned in many places. Numerous churches refused to adopt it in any form, denouncing it as sectarian and without Bible authority. Others believe that it was in the same class with instrumental music, arguing that if you rejected one and accepted the other, you would be inconsistent. Some references in Restoration writings from 1850 to 1900 refer to the fact that a Sunday school was in existence without any particular mention of controversy or division, while others describe the havoc wrought by its introduction. Many of the churches adopting the Sunday school during this time frame had already adopted instrumental music. By the turn of the century, however, the Sunday school question and the division over it had reached major proportions. Even though Eckstein, who wrote a book about the history of the disciples in Texas, discusses it under minor issues, Earl West, in one of his books on the Restoration, admits that it was, and I quote, "by far the most volatile controversy the Brotherhood faced at the beginning of the century." The eye of the storm seemed to be centered in the state of Texas, but reverberations were felt throughout the entire nation. In September 1884, a new religious paper came into being, named The Firm Foundation. That paper would be to Texas and the West what the Gospel Advocate had been to Tennessee and the South. The founder of the paper was Austin McGary. Austin McGary was a very conservative individual, and he was well aware of the tide of innovations and digression sweeping over the church of that day. One of the first disputes over the Sunday school in the state of Texas occurred in 1875, when G.W. Harvey labeled it as a device to attract little children and to keep them from the prairie on the Lord's Day, running mule-eared rabbits, riding jacks, and doing mischief generally. David Lipscomb, who was the editor of the Gospel Advocate, defended the Sunday schools early on. It was McGarry who replied to one of editor Lipscomb's articles by saying, "Away with Sunday schools, even if Brother Lipscomb had memorized the whole New Testament at Sunday school. If the apostles did not have Sunday schools, we do not need them, and we should not have them." It might come as quite a surprise to a lot of people today to know that the Firm Foundation, when established, opposed Sunday schools. Not only was McGarry opposed to it, but many of the other editors who joined him in that early endeavor were equally stiff in their opposition against this innovation. When J.E. Dunn arrived in Peoria, Texas in 1898, he said he found the church divided over instrumental music and Sunday schools. Such was the case in many churches throughout the state in that day and time. Later in 1906, Nimrod L. Clark became editor of the Firm Foundation along with Dr. G.A. Trott, who had already been serving for a number of years. These men, along with McGarry, were all opposed to the modern Sunday school, and their opposition was very fierce, and the sword which they used was very pointed and effective. As is the case, however, with innovations as they creep into the body of Christ, this innovation, the Sunday school, was making its inroads into the church. It soon became evident that it was not to be stopped, and the movement itself not to be deterred. Even McGarry softened his stand against the Sunday school, and in later life accepted the fact that there was nothing wrong with it. N.L. Clark, however, never did. He opposed the Sunday schools as long as he lived. So also with Dr. Trott, who later would leave the Firm Foundation because of its liberal direction and would become involved with a paper published out of Dallas known as the Apostolic Way. These men remained firm in their opposition to the Sunday school movement. The truth of the matter is, as one surveys and reviews the historical data that is available, the Sunday school movement grew out of Protestant denominational sectarianism. Even though it was reluctantly adopted by many of the denominations early on, there were others who were eager in their acceptance of this practice. Sooner or later, it was inevitable that some in the body of Christ would look upon this new venture as being desirable. This was the case. It was adopted into the Church of Christ just like every other innovation, often over the protest of sincere people who believed it to be an addition to the teachings of the New Testament. As a result, the church was divided. Divided very seriously and severely, especially in the Southwest. There were disputes, there were debates, there were lawsuits, buildings were lost, and souls were lost as well. But the movement succeeded. Sunday schools were added, and even though the price was high, the majority of the churches claiming to be churches of Christ embraced the modern Sunday school. Most of them today continue to embrace it. Not because the apostles practiced it, and not because Jesus taught it, not even because the New Testament indicates that it should be adopted, but simply because, like all other innovations, it appeared to be something that people wanted to do. And because they wanted to do it more than they wanted to do what the Bible taught, they adopted it. Think about it, friend. Every time you walk into a modern Sunday school room and observe one of those classes, you are observing something that is an innovation. You're observing a practice that is nowhere taught or authorized in the New Testament scriptures.